Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it is episode 7 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo. He is Thomas Neff. We've got an awesome show lined up for you guys. John Molinaro, one of the godfathers of Canadian soccer journalism, will join us to discuss Toronto FC and the CONCACAF Champions League, his career, and more. But we will start with the intricate details, as it were, from TFC's surprising 1-1 draw with Lyon last Wednesday. The second leg, which will be played in Toronto's temporary home in Orlando, kicks off this upcoming Wednesday with the winner facing either Cruz Azul or Arcai in the quarterfinals, Thomas.
That is correct. To help us break it down with the side of Lyon, we have Cesar Hernandez of ESPN, and he joins us from San Diego. Cesar, thanks so much.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on the pod. Looking forward to chatting Liga MX, chatting CCL. I can't believe it's already back, by the way. It kind of caught me off guard, I'm not going to lie.
So as Peter touched on earlier, this is a surprise draw from TFC's perspective. Lyon had played 19 games since TFC's last game. Do you think Lyon let the victory slip away despite a dominant performance?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I think about that 1-1 draw, I think from my perspective, I think it's fair to say that Lyon were the better side. I would say that their opportunities were probably worthy of them getting at least a couple of goals. But considering the fact that Toronto were apparently missing a bunch of players, I think Toronto should probably be thrilled with how it went. From Lyon's perspective, I know you know, we're going to talk about in a little bit from Toronto's perspective, but from Lyon's perspective, what stood out to me were just the big misses from Ángel Mena, the chances that Joel Campbell had, the fact that Joel Campbell almost scored an absolute golazo, which almost seemed to hit not just the post, but inside of the post, which could have given Lyon two goals there. I thought Yairo Moreno looked incredible off the bench for Lyon and created some chances, but you know, they just weren't finishing them. And you can see that there were a lot of, you know, fans online who were clearly bothered with what was happening to Lyon, because you know, this is Lyon's side that had a little bit of a championship hangover, if you will, after winning the Apertura title in 2020, you know, with that, you know, quick turnaround with just a couple of weeks off. I mean, if that, even if it's just a couple of weeks during December, you know, some of these teams struggle to prep for the 2021 Clausura season. So Lyon did struggle earlier this season. I think people kind of were worried, just like, oof, is this the same Lyon, that can't really capitalize on these chances, the same Lyon that really struggled? But I don't know. I still feel a little optimistic. I still feel as if they're going to bounce back in the second leg. But nonetheless, I think you have to give credit for Toronto for holding just one goal.
Well, you touched on it there a little bit. We talked to Javier Urquieta of the Lions Den podcast about this last week. But Cesar, why do you think Lyon have been as inconsistent as they've been in the Clausura? Is it just simply a championship hangover and as simple as that, or is there more to it?
I mean, yeah, I mean, we can dive into it a little bit there, that in quotes championship hangover. I mean, fans were criticizing key players from Lyon for not really stepping up. I think they've looked a little too defensive or vulnerable defensively. And I think you had some question marks over some key players not getting enough minutes, you know, for whatever reason. Their true number nine, Gigliotti, hasn't been a go-to starter. There was a strange short period earlier in the season where starting goalkeeper, you know, Rodolfo Cota wasn't in the 11. And I think all of that mixed with this, championship hangover, if you will, mixed with players not really stepping up or kind of stepping back a bit after winning their championship. What followed was just two wins in their first 10 Liga MX matches. And that was, and I think it's important to also recognize that although that was a story and that's something that people discuss when they talk about Lyon this season, I think something that we do have to recognize as well is that by mid-March, I know that seems like it's not too long ago, but by mid-March, it's almost as if there was this sudden realization that they really need to start collecting points and wins. You know, after spending most of the season in the bottom four spots, Leon recently, at least in Liga MX, they've looked like, I mean, I guess a better way of putting it is just they've looked like Leon. You know, they tighten up their defense. They score. Opposition were scoring fewer goals. Leon looked more energetic with their pressing. They created higher quality chances, and they had three consecutive wins before facing Toronto mm-hmm. in that first CCL leg. So I think people were expecting a little bit more of Leon. And I think over 180 minutes, I expect Leon will end up getting the win here, but still, nonetheless, I can say whatever I want, but that's still 1-1 result after the first leg.
Now, Toronto FC have been very secretive when it comes to who's available, who's not available. We didn't even know. There was a couple hints of who was going to be in the 11, but obviously Mexico and obviously being what it is over there with the reporting and whatnot, it's reported that Captain Montes, who was absent in the first leg, will be back along with Osvaldo Rodriguez and Jairo Moreno, who are also expected to start on Wednesday. How do you think that will affect the game?
It'll be interesting because, you know, for the most part from Leon this season, you've seen a little bit of a 4-4-2, maybe a 4-3-3. But I think knowing that they really have a point to make here, I think they're going to add Luis Montes while also keeping Fernando Navarro in the starting 11. So what I mean by that is, as opposed to what looked like a 4-4-2, I think it's be a very, very attack-minded, high-pressing 4-2-3-1. I think you're going to have Luis Montes, who's basically, I mean, he is the conductor. You know, he's definitely the conductor of this squad. He's the heart of the 11. And I think that you'll see him in that 4-2-3-1 at what could potentially look like a defensive midfielder, but he's not going to be playing a defensive midfielder. He's going to be playing almost like a 10 behind the other 10, which will probably be Navarro, who I think will be pushing higher up. So I think if I was Ambriz, what I would do is you would bring Jairo Moreno into the 11. You'd bring Luis Montes into the 11. And what that would mean is you would still have Victor Davila up top, but then you would have Meneses on one wing, Angel Mena on the other wing. You would have Navarro as the 10 who'd be pushing forward. You would have Luis Montes pushing forward as well, right behind him. And on the fullbacks, you'd have Avion Ramirez on the right-hand side and Jairo Moreno on the left-hand side, pushing even further forward to really, really make this overwhelming for Toronto. Because I expect that from Ambriz. It's something that Ambriz has done. He's never been, you would say when Leon have been at their best and not when they've struggled, like early this season, they've been at their best when they really overwhelm teams with this pressing style. So I think he's going to really, really step things up. You know, you could say that could still give an opportunity for Toronto through some counterattacks, but they're going to want to dominate possession. They're going to want to create chances. And I think that's what we'll see.
Well, maybe looking into that second leg, obviously Lyon hosted the first leg in their own stadium with fans present. Mm-hmm. Now Toronto is the quote unquote home team in Orlando at essentially a neutral venue for both sides. How do you think that's going to play into the second leg?
Oh, that's huge. I think that's massive. I don't know how you guys feel, but I think Lyon fans are a bit relieved because when they think of the CCL, when they think of a potential atmosphere that can change or alter the outcome of a game, they immediately think about LAFC. You know, I think a lot of Leon fans, especially those who visited Los Angeles, who visit LAFC, who, you know, because there are a lot of Liga MX fans who regularly belittle what's happening in MLS. They regularly look down upon what's happening, you know, just north of the border. But I think a lot of Leon fans they took that atmosphere a little too lightly. And when you watch that game, when you look at those highlights, when you look at those replays, what happened in that match in Los Angeles, I mean, you have to admit that the crowd had a factor here, and it really, really amplified and really, really made things difficult for Leon. I think there's a sense of relief for a lot of Leon fans, and Leon fans will probably feel a little more confident going into the second leg, knowing that they don't have to deal with something like that, knowing that they don't have to deal with some sort of hostile, you know, ground, some sort of hostile, I don't know, like fans in attendance, of this overwhelming or like, I don't know, just like really, really intimidating kind of atmosphere. So I think because that Leon fans are probably feeling a little confident in, which is what I think it's going to be if I remember correctly, it's essentially it's the training ground for Orlando City, right? So I think Leon fans are feel fairly confident about that, but I don't know how you guys feel about that, because I think Leon fans are feeling a little bit better as opposed to what happened in the CCL last year.
Cesar, obviously talking about specifically the game, what were your impressions of this young Toronto side?
And I rewatched parts of the game earlier today just to kind of like prep for this. And I don't want to say it was beautiful soccer or that it looked organized from Toronto, but you really have to give him credit for, what's the feeling here? I kept thinking like they're buzzing around and closing down lanes, they're closing down chances, and not only just in defense, but you think about the opportunity that they were able to create by forcing that own goal. I believe it's Gallardo, right? Erickson Gallardo who forced that own goal, right. And I think that was kind of like emblematic of like what they were trying to do there. I'm not gonna say that it was like incredible or like fascinating soccer, but it worked, and that's the kind of stuff that you have to do in the CCL sometimes, you know. Like, yeah, I can say whatever I want about XG and be like, well, you know, Leon's XG was 1.73 and Toronto's XG was 0.26, but I mean, that doesn't matter. Toronto were able to walk away with this with a 1-1 draw, and this is walking away from Leon, you know. So I think Toronto were quite impressive, especially since, I mean, obviously you guys know much, much better than I do, but it seemed like they're, according to reports, they're missing a lot of key players. Mm-hmm. It seemed like, you know, Pozuelo, I mean, that's definitely someone I'm definitely aware of, someone who, you know, keeps on MLS every now and then, like that, even that one, that name definitely comes up to mind for me, but this is a side for me that, yeah, like I said, it's just, they're buzzing around, they're closing down lanes, closing down chances, and it seemed like they were just constantly intercepting the ball, so I was impressed. I know, according to some stuff I read last week, that a lot of fans weren't exactly excited about Chris Armas as the manager, but I don't know. Maybe that kind of approach works in CCL. I have no idea. You guys tell me.
What do you think will be the X factor in the second leg?
It's immediately, I mean, without a doubt, it's Luis Montes. I know the issue... Or I think for my perspective, like, the issue wasn't chance creation. It was capitalizing those opportunities in the first leg. And I know that, you know, Luis Montes won't be a striker here. He's not going to be that number nine. But still, he is the big X factor for Leon. He was the X factor last season, despite his age, despite the fact that he's now a veteran who... you know, who's said that, you know, maybe he doesn't want to be a part of the Mexican national team anymore because, you know, might not be given the same opportunities. He might take away from, you know, what he's trying to create in Leon, but nonetheless, you know, he continues to exceed expectations, and he somehow, even his mid-30s, seems to be playing at the very best of his career. And he's such a well-rounded player who can create not only decent chances, he can shoot from distance, he could do defensive work, he covers an incredible amount of ground. So I think for me, easily the X factor here is Luis Montes. And you do also wonder that, you know, maybe as opposed to a Joel Campbell who had that one opportunity that just hit the post and bounced out, maybe if it was Luis Montes who was in the starting 11, you would not only have Ogolasso from Navarro, but in the second half you wouldn't have been surprised to see a golazo from Luis Montes in that same opportunity as well.
Cesar, let's close out with a doozy, why don't we? Looking ahead, yeah, which Liga MX club do you think is the favorite for this year's CCL? Which team do you think stands in an MLS hopeful's way this time?
I think it's got to be America. I know the team that had the most convincing win was Rayados, you know, Monterrey over, mm-hmm, Atletico Pantoja, but as impressed as I've been by Rayados, and as exciting as it has been for Rayados fans with Javier Aguirre, who's come back to coach them, you know, arguably the most impressive Mexican manager after his almost 2-decade-long stint abroad. You know, there's just something that's really clicking with America under Solari, you know, and you've been seeing that this season. You've been seeing just how, I mean, I used the word organized earlier in a couple instances, but like they really are truly organized. They really are really, really clicking under Solati. And there was a lot of skepticism about this manager who had never coached the Liga MX beforehand. A lot of Liga MX media and critics and fans were wondering, like, well, yeah, he coached Real Madrid for a short amount of time, but what does he really know about the league? What does he really know about the style? But he's been thriving in a very short amount of time. And of course, because America's America, they have a very impressive roster. They have depth, and I think they're definitely going to go far. I think they're going to, in theory, they would potentially make things difficult for the Timbers in the quarterfinals, or potentially, you know, Atlanta or Philadelphia Union in the semis, although we'll have to keep track of the Central American sides. But I would say that it's America. But of course, don't count out Rayados, who look like they're set going up against the Columbus Crew in the next round. And of course, you still have, you know, León and Cruz Azul. I know Cruz Azul got that 0-0 draw, but that was with their B-C team, if you will. And I think Cruz Azul at their best can potentially win the CCL as well. But long story short, I'm going to go with América.
It's definitely true. Definitely very true. Well, listen, Cesar, thank you again for coming on and helping us out. Listeners, you can follow on Twitter at Cesar H Football. That's spelled the same way we spell our football here on the show, so it should be very easy to find. Thank you once again, Cesar.
Of course. Thanks for having me, guys.
And joining us now is an esteemed guest, especially for me, as he's been significantly influential on my career and someone I'm proud to call a friend. It's John Molinaro, formerly of Sportsnet and CBC, of course, and now we can say formerly of Campiel.ca as well, right, John?
We can, yeah.
Well, we'll get into the meat and potatoes of your new endeavor in a bit. It is very exciting, bit of a teaser there, listeners, but you can follow him on Twitter at John Molinaro, but I'm sure you already do. We will discuss his career, his thoughts on the state of soccer media in Canada, all that good stuff. But first off, he has covered Toronto FC since its inception, so we'll start with their draw with León last Wednesday. What did you make of the game, John, given everything that the team was dealing with entering that match?
Very surprised by the result, if I'm being perfectly honest. You know, when I saw the lineup and, you know, I heard about, you know, all the players that they were going to be missing, and not insignificant players. I mean, we're talking about Alejandro Pizzuolo and Jonathan Osorio, Chris Mavinga, Nick De Leon, Quentin Westberg. You know, these were all, Justin Morrow, these were all regular starters. And the fact that they were going down into Mexico to play Club León, one of the, you know, the top teams in Liga MX, without so many of their key guys. And then, you know, with guys like, you know, Jacob Schaffelberg and Ralph Prizo and, you know, a lot of youngsters who don't have a terrible amount of experience, I just thought, oh my God, this is not going to bode well. This is going to be a little bit of, you know, lambs being led to the slaughter. But I was pleasantly surprised by, you know, TFC's performance on the night, considering everything, all the guys that they were missing. I think it was about as good a result as they could have expected. They played with, I think, a lot of maturity and a lot of grit and a lot of heart. Rode their luck at times. You know, I think, you know, Club León, but for a lack of finishing, probably could have taken a 2-1 or 3-1 win.
Now, John, asking you about what the club's expectations are in 2021. After you saw this performance, considering they had 8 key missing players, how do you think they'll do? You think they're going to build on their performance at the MLS Cup playoffs?
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly the goal. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, the first round playoff exit last year and the way they exited the playoffs leaves a sour taste in their mouths, and that, you know, there's a sense of that they have some unfinished business to take care of. You know, I don't read too much into one game because, you know, how can you extrapolate anything from that? It's such a small sample size. But again, you know, pleased to see that with the performance, how they sort of performed in such a you know, trying situation. The fact that, you know, I appreciate that a lot of key guys were missing, and that's why a lot of the youngsters saw playing time. But, you know, having talked to Bill Manning, you know, the last couple of days, it seems like this is the way forward. I mean, he told me specifically that they're going to really, that these young kids, Ralph Prizo, Schaffelberg, Jordan Peruzza, they're going to get their playing time this year. They're going to get minutes, and that they really sort of want to rely on, you know, their youth academy products that have come up through the system, you know, the pipeline of talent that they produced. they're going to work into, they're going to see regular playing time this year. And when you look at the sort of track record of Chris Armas and Ali Curtis, from what they did with the New York Red Bulls, that doesn't surprise me, because that was very much their modus operandi when they were with the Red Bulls. So, you know, if you're a fan of, I mean, people have been saying for a while that play the kids, you know, we got to sort of get, this team has to get younger and some fresh legs. And I certainly agree with that, because I think at towards the end of the season last year, when it looked like they were going to win the Supporter Shield, you could tell that they were a little bit tired and that they just needed, I think, some youth in their midst. So I think that's encouraging, and I think you're going to see that continue to play out during the season. Now, whether that means they're going to sort of improve upon their MLS Cup playoff showing from last year, whether that means they'll go farther in the Champions League, you know, far too early to tell. It's only been one game, but I think the early sign is certainly promising.
Well, maybe continuing on that trend of the youth and seeing those young players getting minutes, which players specifically do you expect big things from in 2021? Obviously a lot of options, but if you had to pick one, who would it be?
Well, I mean, it is very difficult. I mean, I think there's something to be said about, you know, Ralph Prieto, the 18-year-old, you know, starting in such an important game like that, you know, in a double pivot next to Michael Bradley. Again, I appreciate that they were missing guys through injury, and that under normal circumstances, he probably wouldn't have started. But to be sort of thrown into that situation down in Mexico in such a meaningful game and put in a pretty good accounting of himself, I think that certainly bodes well for Prieto. Again, having spoken to Bill Manning a couple of days ago, he's really big on him. And you get the sense that the sort of what we were sort of expecting from Liam Fraser, I guess, last year, to sort of step into that role and really sort of become the breakout young star. I suspect that that's, you know, that they're sort of really, really looking to Ralph Prieto for that role this year. I think they are really big on him. They have really high expectations on him. So I suspect he's going to get a lot of playing time this year. But I don't think he's going to be the only one. I mean, I think Jacob Schaufelberg, I know he's, you know, been with the senior team for a few years now. But aside from 2 years ago when he really broke out, I mean, he really wasn't used all that much from last season. And I thought he had a really strong game against Lyon in the first leg. I mean, he was providing quality service for Josie in the box, and I think really just making a pest of himself and frustrating the Club Lyon players. So I think he's going to get some playing time. I think Noble Lokello is going to get some playing time. I think, you know, a lot of those guys, Peruzza is another one that they're really big on. I think they're going to get their opportunities. But I mean, if I were to pick just one, you know, I think Ralph Prieto is the one guy who I would expect big things from this season.
What are you hearing as far as injuries? Could we see any players back for the return leg?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't expect Josie back. Again, having spoken to Bill Manning, he told me that he's going to be undergoing an MRI. And of course, you know, he's had a history of lower body injuries. So still to be determined what the seriousness is of the injury and what the MRI results. But anytime you have an MRI, that's not a good thing. And I suspect he's not going to be back for the next game. I think Alejandro Pozuelo, you know, there's a possibility. The other guys, I think it's more likely that we might see them. But I think for sure, I wouldn't expect to see Jose Altidore in the lineup on Wednesday.
All right, well, we shall see what happens with that. Pivoting over to you specifically, John, you announced that you left campiel.ca, and that kind of came as a bit of a surprise to people. And many are wondering what your next step is. Do you think you can maybe give us some insight on what that next step is?
Yeah, for sure. So today I launched TFC Republic, which is my own sort of paid subscription website that is going to focus on, you know, in-depth coverage and analysis of all things Toronto FC, plus as well Canadian men's and the Canadian women's teams, the Canadian Premier League and Canadian soccer just in general. So it's going to be, you know, if people have been familiar with the work that I've done at Sportsnet and Sun Media and CBC Sports in my 21-year year career in sports journalism, then I think they'll have a pretty good idea of what to expect with TFC Republic and what you know, the type of content that I'll produce. It's going to be very much what people have come to expect from me, just kind of straightforward nuanced, balanced, and fair coverage of Toronto FC and Canadian soccer in general. And it's something I had been thinking about doing for a while, this sort of paid subscription model, which is, I guess, similar to, you know, the Athletic model. Wasn't quite sure if I wanted to do it, what with what's going on in the world with the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, maybe it's not the best time to leave the security of full-time employment at the CPL. But, you know, I just felt it was time to move on from the CPL. It was, I think I got the most I could out of the experience through, and I just wanted to try new things. And, you know, if I'm being honest, you know, I missed covering TFC. Before, you know, I was laid off by Sportsnet in 2019, I covered the team intently since, you know, before it came into the league in 2007. I mean, I was a day one sort of beat reporter for the franchise. And even though I'm not a TFC fan, I loved covering the team. It was such a unique challenge. And I wouldn't have traded for any other beat in Toronto sports coverage. I mean, you could have, you know, when I was at Sportsnet, you could have came to me and said, well, you know, would you rather cover the Leafs or the Raptors or the Blue Jays? Well, definitely not the Blue Jays. There's no way I would cover baseball. But, I wouldn't have traded for the world, because for me, it is the best beat in Toronto sports. So, you know, not being part of it for the better part of, you know, close to 2 years, you know, I was starting to miss it. And I think that was part of the reason why I wanted to launch this website and just return to the TFC beat on a full-time basis.
Now, if you can tell us, can you expand on what this website, what the model is for it, obviously what kind of features will it have, how many subscribers you expect them to have, all that kind of thing?
Sure, yeah. So it's, I mean, I think I think people sort of come to expect, you know, certain types of content from me. They'll know that I'll sort of tell it like I see things, you know, straightforward, honest, credible, balanced coverage of Toronto FC and Canadian soccer. And I think that's going to continue to be sort of the, you know, how I operate, you know, tfcrepublic.ca. You know, in terms of content, you know, let's be honest, I think people can get the daily news anywhere, right? They can go to, you know, any number of sort of online or news websites or newspapers and read about, you know, injury reports and you know, trade rumors and you know, transfer rumors and stuff like that. You know, I will certainly sort of do the regular sort of daily news coverage, but that's not going to be the main selling point of the website. The main selling point of the website will be, you know, original storytelling and feature writing and sort of in-depth articles and big reads that they, you know, probably won't be able to find anywhere else. So, you know, for instance, you know, this week I've got a whole slew of stories. Just as an example, I sat down with, you know, Bill Manning to talk about, you know, a variety of issues on the upcoming season for TFC. So that'll be out later this week. I spoke to Victor Montagliani, the president of CONCACAF, to talk about, and that was a really long discussion. And we discussed a whole bunch of things about, you know, the importance of the CPL to how, you know, the women's game has really grown in the CONCACAF region since he became president, to, you know, the 2026 World Cup, to just some personal stuff about him, because I mean, he is, you know, as a Canadian, it's pretty, I think it's pretty unthinkable that a guy like him, a Canadian, is one of the most influential and powerful figures in international soccer as president of CONCACAF. I'm not sure, you know, a Canadian could have ascended to that role 20 years ago, but here he is, a guy from BC in charge of, you know, CONCACAF. So we talked a little bit about that. So that story is going to be out later on in the week. I talked to Octavio Zambrano, the former Canadian national team coach. He hasn't really sort of spoken about, you know, his departure from the Canadian national team program since he was, you know, replaced by John Herdman in 2018. So, you know, I was able to sort of get him to talk on the record. And he had some interesting things to say about, you know, his time with the national team program, the situation which led to his departure, you know, his dealings with the CSA, being replaced by John. So that was a pretty interesting talk, and that'll be published later on this week. But, you know, for today, for Monday, people can check out such stories. I mean, I have a story about, you know, Chris Armas and how he wants, you know, Michael Bradley to slightly tweak his playing style this year to become more of a two-way player and be cover ground more differently. So that's a long, really long, in-depth piece on that. have a piece about, you know, Atiba Hutchinson at age 38 and everything that he's meant to the national team and you know, what's in store for him for the future. Did a story about Erin McLeod and the Canadian women's national team and how, you know, after a two-year absence, she's fighting to get into the Olympic roster for this summer's Olympics in Tokyo and, you know, the difficult road she faces ahead with that. Did a feature story on how last year, how the CPL essentially stood still for 8 minutes and 46 seconds when, you know, players did their sort of protest ahead of a game, you know, in honor of George Floyd and how that kind of came about and how it was totally player driven and really sort of was at their insistence and how they really sort of forced the league's hand into allowing them to do that. You know, and then there's going to be, you know, so it's going to be stuff like that, really sort of thoughtful, at least what I think is thoughtful and nuanced sort of analysis and coverage of, like I said, not only TFC, but a variety of subjects in Canadian soccer. So really sort of, you know, like I said, features that, you know, maybe you wouldn't necessarily find at any other sort of outlets or websites.
Well, that's great. Listeners, if you want to check it out, there's going to be info in our podcast description. I'm sure John will be tweeting it out. We'll all be promoting it. So keep an eye out for that. Lots of good stuff to come. Maybe looking back, John, before the CPL, you were at Sportsnet for, 8 years? Looking back, what were you most proud of with your work there?
Oh, man. You know, I guess just the sort of daily coverage that I provided or tried to provide of TFC and Canadian soccer, because, you know, I think the Canadian game has historically had a tough time getting regular, consistent and thoughtful media coverage in this country. You know, it's still, you know, sports media in Canada is still, you know, its primary focus is still on hockey. And then to a lesser extent, you know, the Blue Jays and now, you know, the Raptors have become such a big deal in the last few years that it's made it increasingly hard for soccer to get its to get the coverage that I think it deserves. So I think just the fact that I was able to, you know, again, provide regular in-depth coverage of the three Canadian teams in MLS and of the national teams and of the CPL, that to me was what I guess I was particularly proud of. And, you know, Sportsnet was really great in that they gave me a lot of freedom to do kind of what I wanted and to shape the coverages I saw fit. So, you know, I was able to do unique stuff like go to Halifax for HFX Wanderers, you know, home debut, spend a couple of days there, get a really sense of what, you know, the return of professional soccer to Nova Scotia meant to the city and how the city was embracing its, you know, its latest pro sports franchise. And then come back and then write a full in-depth story about that and what it was like, you know, to sort of cover the TFC beat, the fact that they were allowed me to cover, you know, TFC in a similar way that, you know, they had reporters do with the Leafs or, you know, the Blue Jays, and to write a big read story on like an oral history on the history of the team and to talk to like 40 people involved from, you know, Tim Leiwicki to Danny Dicchio to, I mean, basically, I was able to talk to everybody I wanted except for Mo Johnson to, you know, to sort of tell that story about the genesis and the just sort of the history of the team. That was pretty, I think that was pretty significant. So a lot to be proud of during my time at Sportsnet. And, you know, even though, you know, I was laid off, you know, I never bore any grudge against them and I still don't because they were very good to me. And, they really allowed me to do, you know, pretty much what I wanted with very little oversight because I think they just trusted in the quality of the work that I was doing. So I'll always be eternally grateful to them for that.
John, you were also at CBC. What was that like? Obviously, two different outlets. Did you work for CBC Sports? Did you work for CBC News? What are the differences between the two and how long were you there for?
Yeah, so before I was at Sportsnet, I was at CBC Sports for, well, it would have been 2002 to 2011, so 9 years. So, yeah, I worked for the CBC Sports website, which was a great experience. What happened was, like, my first job out of journalism school was working for Sun Media, for working for their website, And I did that for 2 years. And unfortunately, there was a big round of layoffs in, it would have been kind of April, early May of 2002. And I got caught up in them, unfortunately. But the timing was fortuitous in the sense that the CBC had the broadcast rights for the 2002 FIFA World Cup that year. And they wanted to produce the website, cbcsports.ca, wanted to produce kind of like their own mini website dedicated just to the World Cup. But unfortunately, they didn't have anyone on staff who really knew soccer. And so they were really at, they were really kind of, you know, worried about how they were going to pull this off without having someone with the expertise to do it. And so this was when I was laid off. And as it so happens, a good friend of mine happened to work for CBC Sports. And he said, well, look, you're laid off. I can give you the name of, you know, the editor of CBC Sports, you know, reach out to him, tell him that you're available and that, you know, you can tell him that we spoke and see what he says. So I emailed him, this great guy who became my boss named Andrew Lundy. It was within 5 minutes, he emailed me back. And when I saw the email pop up, I'm like, okay, well, this is promising then. So yeah, that was kind of my entree into CBC Sports. I kind of oversaw, I was the editor in chief of their World Cup website for their 2000 and for the 2002 tournament. And after that was done, they kept me on a freelance basis for a year. And then after the year was up, they made me full time. And I was there for, like I said, 9 years. And, you know, for most of it, I was doing just regular sports coverage, you know, focusing on soccer, but other things as well. So, you know, I had to write hockey and I had to write basketball and a lot of amateur sports. But they let me sort of really spread my wings on the soccer stuff. In 2011, Sportsnet had the broadcast rights to the FIFA Women's World Cup in Germany, and they had sub-licensed part of the rights to CBC. So CBC was a partner. And instead of, you know, the CBC doing their own sort of World Cup website dedicated to their coverage and Sportsnet doing their own website, they just decided to work together on doing a joint website for the Women's World Cup that summer. And I was put in charge of that. Which was great. So, because I got to work a little bit with the Sportsnet guys and, you know, work on like a joint project like that. And when it was done, Sportsnet essentially sort of reached out to me and said, well, look, we're expanding at the moment. You know, would you be interested in coming on, coming to work for us as our full-time sort of chief soccer reporter? And you'd be overseeing, you know, our expanded soccer section. Which was obviously something I was very interested in and, you know, had the discussion with them. And, you know, I left CBC on very good terms. They were very happy for me and then went to Sportsnet and things kind of just went from there. But had a great time at CBC. I have a lot of time. I still have some good friends there who I've known. And it was just a fantastic experience.
Probably couldn't have asked for two better places to work at back to back, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very fortunate.
Yeah, definitely. Well, maybe to close it out, John, a bit of a loaded question here, but we're seeing a dramatic shift in soccer in Canada in terms of how it's presented or, you know, how the content is made available and whatnot. The rights to Canadian soccer, of course, belong to One Soccer and Media Pro, largely. DAZN scooped up a lot of major European rights in the last couple of years. TSN and Sportsnet are still involved, but much less compared to even the mid-2010s. There was a lot of debate about this during Canada's World Cup qualifiers about the sustainability of the streaming model, whether games, whether it's European games or national team games, what have you, should be on traditional networks. So what do you think about these changes to soccer broadcasting here these last few years? Is it good or bad for the sport's growth and soccer journalism in general here?
Well, I think it's the wave of the future. I mean, it's I just see that it's the way it's trending, that, you know, more and more of, you know, these streaming companies are going to get in the game and they're going to scoop up the broadcast rights. You know, DAZN is not some fly-by-night operation. One Soccer has Media Pro behind them, who, and for people who don't know, this is like a major media empire in Spain. So they have money behind them. So the fact that, you know, DAZN and One Soccer are scooping up these rights, it doesn't surprise me in the least. People, I know, I was kind of following the debate along the line, you know, during the World Cup qualifiers about, well, these games should be on traditional networks and you know, what's One Soccer doing? Look, One Soccer are not the bad guys in this. The argument that these games should be on you know, traditional TV so everyone can see them. Yeah, I agree, but they're not. That's the problem. You know, Rogers and Bell, God love them, they didn't step up to buy these rights. And, you know, so what's the alternative? Them, you know, them not being available? You know, One Soccer has stepped up, and they're showing them. And they're showing them, and they're not just sort of plugging in and playing some foreign feed. Most times, the majority of the times, it's, you know, it's their own studio coverage, which means, you know, pregame, postgame, halftime analysis, they're doing it all themselves. So they're seriously investing in it. So they should be applauded for what they're doing, not sort of harangued for taking all these rights. Again, they're not the bad guys in all this. Would I love to see, you know, soccer on more traditional networks such as TSN and Sportsnet? Sure. But, you know, that's not the media landscape we're living in, especially now, you know, during the pandemic, where I think a lot of these sort of major sort of media outlets are, you know, penny pinching, right? You know, unfortunate as it is, soccer is going to bear the brunt of that. So I think you're going to see, if anything, you're going to see less coverage on platforms like TSN and Sportsnet, and more on online streaming services. So people might not like it. I appreciate that, but people should get used to it, because I do think that's sort of the wave of the future, and that's what's going to happen. You know, again, it's just sort of the way that I see the industry is trending. You know, I think it's, again, I think it's, it behooves people to, if they really want to support Canadian soccer, then I think they should support One Soccer and sort of subscribe to the service. If you can't afford it and it's beyond your means, then I get it, right? I mean, I'm not going to sort of take you to task for that. But if the argument is that, well, you know, I don't want to pay for content, then, you know, I don't have much sympathy for you. Everything costs money these days. You know, nothing is for free. This notion that coverage was free on TSN and Sportsnet is a fallacy. You know, you pay for those channels. It's part of your cable bill. You don't get those for nothing. You have to pay a price. So it's not any different than DAZN or One Soccer. So, you know, for me, they're investing in really helping to raise the profile of the Canadian game. And I think they should be applauded for their efforts, because I think they're really making an honest and sincere go of it.
Yeah, honestly, couldn't have said it better myself. I think that's really what it boils down to. Well, listen, I don't know if I can speak for Thomas here, but this has been a pleasure, John. Thank you so much for joining me. Thomas, I'm sure it was a pleasure for you as well.
Yeah, John, thanks so much for taking the time. There's such few journalists out there that can go independent. And if there is a guy in Canadian soccer, it's you. I've grown up reading your work. It's nice to hear about your story, because it's different now, the 2020 onwards, than it was before, in sports media at least.
Yeah, it is a lot different. Thank you for the kind words, both of you. That's very nice. I appreciate the support, and hopefully everyone listening will sort of subscribe to tfcrepublic.ca. So it's I'm really excited about this, and I hope others are as well.
All right, Thomas, moving over to some Canadians abroad chat. We'll start with some good news, and that is related to Jonathan David's injury. La Voix du Nord, a local newspaper in Lille, reported that David has been running since his injury, although he is still likely a couple of weeks away from a return to the pitch. That would be Lille's match against Lyon, a massive game that will be in their title run-in. Now, in terms of David's injury, he was initially diagnosed to be out for several weeks by Lille. It was looking not at all positive for even him coming back for the rest of the season, let alone, you know, in a couple of weeks. So are you surprised by these recent developments?
Yes, it's good to see him, because maybe there was some chat that perhaps this could have been one of the last games that Lille played Jonathan David, not only due to his injury, but due to the financial crisis that Lille is going through. That there is some talk that Lille have to sell this summer. But no, it's good to see Jonathan David, because I believe we are going to need him in June. Not only against Suriname, perhaps, who are the stronger opponent of the two games, but certainly against Haiti. But I think we will need him. I think for those two games, I think we will have rotation for sure, because you're going to be playing four games, and this is all around good news.
Well, certainly it is good news, and obviously it is, because it did not look great. Now, here's where I'm a little bit hesitant, because I know a lot of people who, granted, they were not playing in a top five European league, but they were professional players, and they've had injuries like this, and ankle sprains of that variety can be long-lasting and sometimes require surgery to fully repair it based on the ligament damage or the severity of the ligament damage. So I'm just concerned whether David is actually fully over the injury without any sort of complications, without the possibility of him re-aggravating it. Because as we have seen throughout the entire year, pretty much since football returned after the pandemic, players have been run into the ground. And the fact that he is going to be playing in some pivotal matches, now albeit Lille is not in Europe, which helps, but they're going to be playing pivotal matches for a title. Then you imagine he's going to be called up for national team games in June, maybe not July, but certainly June. And then he's right into preseason. And that's where you worry that he might be overloaded and then he maybe risks re-aggravating the injury. But it could also be the complete other direction in that this was just very minor. He seems to be fine, and he plays pretty much the same way he did before the injury. One thing I'll say, just rebutting the whole, you know, will Jonathan David be sold? I don't think it even happens, even if he was fit, because I just don't think any club in Europe, especially in a pandemic, would be willing to pay more than the 35 million euros that Lille paid for him. I understand they have financial issues, but you also have to keep in mind that Renato Sanchez is in pretty good form. I know he doesn't start every single week, but he could be sold for a pretty hefty profit. Sven Botman has a lot of big European clubs looking at him. He could be sold for massive amounts of money. Zeki Celik as well, their right back, is getting a lot of interest. There are players there who they can sell off and still make a sizable enough amount of cash to be able to offset having to sell David. So I think he's more than safe for Leo for at least another year at this point. Plus, they're going to be in the Champions League. That's extra money. I don't think they'll have to worry about that. I don't know, Thomas, do you have the same concerns when it comes to the severity of his injury or whether he's actually fully over it, or are you just kind of taking a wait-and-see approach here?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing here is that he's very young. So as a young player, you have to manage him correctly. I know he's playing a lot of games, and like you said, it's a good thing that Lille are no longer in European competitions. But if Lille have to go for preseason in July, and he does get called up to the Canadian team in June, if it's best for his fitness, then absolutely. I think you always have to prioritize club football ahead of national team football, as much as fans and journalists want to see players all the time. But you're going to have to see him progress. I mean, if he does miss the Gold Cup and it's because Lille really, really need him to, you know, take a break from it all, then so be it. I mean, look, I mean, Lille, they've managed so many players at the same time. Like you just mentioned there, Renato Sanchez coming in and out of the lineup. You don't want to see Jonathan David become that kind of player, more of a rotational player. But if his injury certainly becomes it that way, then you might be looking at a load management situation.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we'll obviously have to find out how good or bad this recovery is. But look, take nothing away from this. The fact that he is at least returning to some form of exercise is clearly good news. We'll just see if there's any long-term repercussions in the future. Sticking on the good news theme here, Atiba Hutchinson, the ageless wonder himself, he had 3 assists in Besiktas' 3-0 win over Alanyaspor on Thursday. He followed that up with an assist for Kyle Larin's goal in Sunday's victory. Now, I don't think he was eventually credited with it. I don't know why, because it pretty clearly was an assist, but I digress. Thomas, I know we've discussed Stefano Stacchio being an undisputed starter or potentially being in the conversation to be an undisputed starter for a couple weeks here, but I feel like we still can't forget 2 things. Number one, we must clone Atiba Hutchinson. And number 2, he is still a very valuable player who can play in a variety of roles in the odd game for Canada whenever he wants to make himself available.
Yes, clone Atiba, 100%. No, look, 3 assists in 1 game, that's exceptional. I think he was, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's won player of the year at Besiktas several times now. He's actually seen as one of the big leaders there. And the thing for me is his age. He looks good for his age. He's in club form. So why should he retire from the national team? That's been the biggest conversation point at this point. But realistically, if you have him on, does it affect the development of younger guys? This is probably, not probably, this is Atiba Hutchinson's last chance to go to World Cup. If he, in fact, takes part throughout the entire World Cup qualifying cycle. But when he does fly to Canada, he is always the captain. He's always named the captain. Obviously, we had Scott Arfield, who obviously decided to stay in Scotland due to club commitments. But more so than that, I don't know. For me, I don't know. Some people will say otherwise, but what he does in Besiktas is amazing. What I saw in the Bermuda game, and again, it's tough to tell because almost everyone played well, and it is Bermuda. But I feel like his impact is greater at club than national team. I want to see him do exactly what he does at club and national team. And I know it's hard because with club players, he spends in a 365-day calendar. Yearly, he probably spends 200 days with the same guys, the same 20 guys. So I know it's difficult. But I want to see Atiba Hutchinson do the same thing he does at Besiktas and bring it over to national team. And if he can't, then at least maybe come number 10, maybe more of a playmaker, more of a leader, which he is. He is a leader. Maybe have him on the team, but not always play him, because we saw that he flew back to Turkey after the second game. Sorry, after the first game, missing the second game. And John Herdman explained that he was in recovery mode. So maybe if he does come in, I do agree with you that if he does come in, he doesn't always start. You start him one game and sit him out the other game, or sub him out. I think his leadership attributes, that's without question. But I don't know. I at least from the time that I have seen the national team program, maybe I'm young, perhaps. Like I definitely wasn't a follower of the national team when he debuted, right? And he debuted a long time ago, right? But from what I've seen the last couple of years, and it's hard to tell because we've played against weak competition, except with a few other games. But in the games that I've seen, I just don't think Atiba has shown what he's done at club and brought it to the national team.
Well, I think the biggest reason for that, and you touched on it there, he is playing in a more advanced role at Besiktas. Now, it's not a fixed position. He's very active across the pitch. Like, if you just even look at his heat maps, he's everywhere. and it's quite nuts to see, considering the guy's pushing 40 and he's still covering like 10, 11 kilometers a game. It's ridiculous. But if you want to see him kind of replicating that club form with the national team, and look, I don't think anybody's going to be able to fully replicate what they do for club and country. It's just really not possible for all the reasons you stated. But you feel like if they're going to do that, that's the way that they would do it, is just to play him a bit more advanced, or play him in a trio, which I guess Canada still uses, but play him as one of those box-to-box guys in the trio, have Ostakio sit, and then, I don't know, have Marc-Anthony Kay, have Scott Arfield on the other side, again, going box-to-box. You could very easily do that, really. But you talk about respect. We hear how much the players revere Atiba. Just how excited they are to play with him. We heard John Herdman after the, I believe it was after the Bermuda game, and he was talking about how excited Stefan Ostakio was to play next to and play with Atiba Hutchinson, and he was studying his games at Besiktas to see how he could best complement him, things like that. Like, that's really cool to see, is it not? But I feel like no matter how you deploy Atiba Hutchinson, he's still going to give you something of value, really, whether it's in a deeper role as part of a midfield pivot or in another role as part of a trio.
Yeah, I mean, for me, what he does really, really good is recovering the ball, slowing things down, mm-hmm. and then starting up the play again. But again, it is so difficult to really analyze against a game like Bermuda. Perhaps there is still room for him. I definitely do think there is. I mean, otherwise, if there wasn't, I wouldn't see why John Herdman would be calling him.
Of course.
But if Canada do go back to the 4-3-3, and you take experience as the number one factor, then it would be a Hutchinson, Piet, and Arfield. And you have the younger crop, guys like Ostakio, 24 years old, Marc-Anthony Kay, 26, same age as Piet, and everyone else, right? I mean, David Wotherspoon, who is a depth player. You could even throw in Russell Tybert. But like I said before, does it impact the development, not development in terms of age, but does a guy like Jonathan Osorio deserve it more? You have to ask yourself these questions, right?
First of all, what's your obsession with Russell Tybert? I really don't understand the obsession with Russell Tybert. I feel like anytime a midfield conversation comes up, he always gets mentioned. And I'm like, I don't understand it, but that's just me.
It's a good conversation to have, because maybe for the first time in, I don't know, a long time, we actually have six good midfielders that, you know, we can have two teams.
And Russell Tybert's part of that, you think?
For me, he is. I rate him. Ooh, okay. I know you don't.
All right. Okay. No, listen, this show's all about opinions, Thomas. We're not saying anyone's right or wrong, but you are definitely wrong. I'm definitely right. I'm just kidding. Don't worry. Look, in terms of what the best trio is or who's available or who gets called up, it really just depends on the opponent and the situation of the game that you really want to play, the tactics you want to play. If you want more solidity, if you want a bit more protection, yeah, you go Piet with Hutchinson, with Kay, or with whoever. If you want more control of the ball, really dominate a game, you go with Ostakio deep, and it's not even a debate at that point for me. But this is what's amazing, is that, I don't know about you, Thomas, but myself, I thought Atiba Hutchinson was going to slow down noticeably, emphasis on noticeably, about 4 years ago. And he signs a new contract with Besiktas. He's been killing it ever since. He's still in the national team conversation, even though he announced his retirement officially from the national team after the 2019 Gold Cup, but the way it ended, he probably didn't want to go out that way, and the fact he was playing very well still had a lot to do with it. But it's amazing to see, really. And the midfield, as a result, is now loaded. And we can probably say the same thing these days with the centre-back depth, because another man who had a busy week was Scott Kennedy. He started back-to-back matches in the league, in the second Bundesliga, and the DFB Pokal semi-finals, which Jan Regensburg lost to Werder Bremen 1-0 in. I imagine, Thomas, he's going to get a call-up, because the fact John Herdman brought him up in the pre-match conference call and said that he was heard and this and that indicates that he's on the radar. Does he deserve a call-up? And if so, where does he fit on the pecking order in terms of the left-sided centre-backs or left-footed centre-backs right now?
He 100% deserves a call-up. And to me, because the level that he's playing at and the age that he's at, he's a starter for me.
Okay, continue.
I don't see how we can keep relying on Steven Vitoria. He's 34. He's playing at a good club in mid-table Portuguese league in Liga NOS. But again, I just go back to the Gold Cup against Haiti. I'm just scared of that happening again, because he just gets beat out in easily situations, and his age really shows against more quicker players. So for me, I'd rather count on a young center back if they're both at the same level.
Okay.
Like for me, if Kamal Miller's playing, and if it's a decision between Kamal Miller and Steven Vitoria, I go with Kamal Miller every time. I don't know how you feel about it, but again, for me, it's different with Ricardo Ferreira, because he's still 28 years old, and he has accomplished more than Steven Vitoria. Let's not forget, Ricardo Ferreira has played in the Europa League with Braga, and Braga being one of the top four clubs in Primera Liga. It's funny because you also have other four or five center backs that are also could be in the picture, depending if Derek Cornelius is in Marc Dos Santos' plans. That's something to consider as well. Frank Sturing, second division of Holland. Does Frank Sturing stay in the second division, or does he make a move to the Eredivisie? So there's just so much to consider. But Scott Kennedy, you know, he's young, you know, he's 22, 23. So for me, he comes in and he's a starter just because the level that he's at. And we haven't seen a player like, what was the last time we had a player playing in the second division of the top five leagues? I think Kevin McKenna, no?
Yeah, it's been a while for sure. So look, I don't disagree with you on what you said about Vitoria or Scott Kennedy and the level he's playing at. He's certainly more comfortable playing in a higher line because, look, in the Bundesliga or even just in German football in general, they play a very high tempo. They play with high defensive lines. So he's used to that, which is very, very helpful in this situation because Canada, under John Herdman, they want to play with that high line. They want to play on the front foot. And Scott Kennedy, one of the biggest strengths that he has is that he reads the game defensively very, very well. Like, he anticipates something happening in an instant, and that is what really helps him. Now, he does have decent pace, nothing outstanding, but above average. Has been burned once or twice, but that's going to happen when you're facing really fast players, right? And there's nothing you can do about speed. The only downside is he's not very good on the ball or particularly strong on the ball either. Dominant in the air, clearly reads the game defensively very well. All you have to do in that situation, if he were to start, is just don't really rely on him in your buildup. Partner him with someone a little more technically advanced, whoever that happens to be, whether, you know, it is Ricardo Ferreira. I personally wouldn't start him next to them because then you don't really have any pace at center back, which is a bit of an issue. And this is where the problem kind of lies. And this is where I feel like, and I think it just all depends on who's playing, because chances are Kamal Miller and Derek Cornelius, for whatever reason, probably won't be regular starters with their clubs in MLS. Scott Kennedy will be.
And then there's also the situation of Daniel Henry.
Yes, exactly. So that is almost a situation where Daniel Henry might be the more ideal partner next to Scott Kennedy, because he's more, and I understand when I say this, people kind of cringe and they get a little bit nervous, but it's almost like a yin and yang situation between Kennedy and Henry. Kennedy's a little more reserved, and he's a little more, he'll just kind of lurk in the shadows and then kind of know when he has to push up and whatnot, whereas Henry's a lot more rambunctious in that way. But he is, in a way, more technically advanced on the ball, especially now that he's been in Korea and has been used to playing with the ball a lot more. So maybe that is the way to go. We shall see.
Yeah, it's interesting. I definitely do think that you decide to take two players that are different. If you take two players that are the same, two fast center backs with a lot of pace, for me, the kind of center back that I like is a tall center back. One that you can count on to head a lot of balls. But I don't know. I think Canada, especially against the Mexicos, the USAs, the Costa Ricas, I think what you need there is good marking ability. And sometimes the Canadian defender hasn't had that. But at the same time, then you have some Canadian defenders who are super tall, but just lack that technical ability. So
yeah,
I would like to have like a Steven Vitoria type, a little bit younger, version of Steven Vitoria, you know, physical, tall, with experience, and then a younger pairing, than a younger a partner per se. So someone who isn't afraid to get forward, because at the end of the day, right now, I don't see any national team that has defenders that stay back the entire game.
Of course.
I mean, at least I haven't seen it. I mean, you watch not only friendlies but in World Cup qualifying. You need defenders that only can head the ball, that can clear the ball, that can make passes. But if you're occasionally needed, let's say your team needs a one goal to tie it or whatever, don't be afraid to go in and head or wait for the midfielder to give you the ball so you can recover it and give it off to the wing. So I definitely would like someone like that. I wouldn't want someone who is more just has the physical attributes and then is more reserved when it comes to, you know, playing with the midfield or even the forwards.
Well, and the one thing I'll say to wrap this up is it also depends how they're deployed, right? And one of the big reasons why Steven Vitoria has struggled in that U.S. game, in games previous where he's been exploited in counterattacking situations, is the team wasn't set up to protect him and to have an overall decent defensive shape in transition. And no matter who it is that starts at center back, you need to have that. And on top of that too, having a player like Stefano Stacchio in the midfield to have an outlet to pass it to who can then play through pressure is so huge. So all that plays into this, really. No matter who ends up starting at center back, whether it is Kennedy or Miller or Cornelius or Henry, whoever it is. Let's close out the show with a little bit of Canadian women's national team talk, Thomas. We closed out the show last week talking about them. They have since played their first of two friendlies. They beat Wales 3-0, and they will end up playing England on Tuesday to close out this friendly series. The big news from that first game, though, was Christine Sinclair's injury, but it's not believed to be serious. The reason I'm bringing this up is she has been a regular starter despite her advanced age, despite maybe not being the most athletically gifted striker out there. But now that there seem to be more options coming through who are able to finish in a composed manner, who have that incisiveness about them, is it maybe time to start looking at how others could fare in that position? Because Evelyn Vion came on in her place and looked fantastic, really. I mean, took that goal very, very well and has done so for the last year now, playing outstanding, scoring goals in bunches, and same with Chloe Lacasse as well in Portugal. Do you think it's time that someone else starts to be brought in place of Sinclair, given that we saw what happened with the United States and Abby Wambach? She was slowly kind of phased out and then became a super sub, and that worked out well. Should Canada do the same thing?
I think Canada should use Kristen Sinclair as long as she is playing regularly in club football, in the case for her with Portland Thorns. If Kristen Sinclair is scoring and playing regularly in the NWSL, then there is no reason why she shouldn't be in the national team. Now, as far as who starts, well, if you have players that are already have reached, I don't want to say the level of Kristen Sinclair, because it's one thing the level, and the other thing is the legacy, right? I mean, the numbers, of course. I think that's the other thing. But Kristen Sinclair is the captain of this team. I mean, so many of these players look up to her. So I feel like leaving her out of the 11, I don't know. I just think it would send a confusing message. But it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. Like, I think, you know, we look at some national teams, and not just in the men's, but the women's. Like, one player retires or leaves the program, and it's just very, very difficult to cope without that player. Canada has depth. So let's say, hypothetically, not saying that's going to happen, I have no clue. If this is Sinclair's last, this has to be her last Olympics. I mean, I can't imagine her going 41. But if she does, I mean, that would be incredible. Let's say this is not only her last Olympics, but her last major tournament as a Canadian national team member. You have so much depth coming through that at the end of the day, Kristen Sinclair went out in the 33rd minute injured. And what I said before, when Jonathan David wasn't called up against Bermuda, and of course Bermuda and Wales are two different quality of opponents, but she wasn't missed, because you just have so many good players playing in such good leagues that Kristen Sinclair can even be a player on the bench to give leadership. But you have quality, so her absence wasn't felt as much.
And that's what's so intriguing about this. And this is why you should test everybody out as much as you possibly can, get as many players familiar with your style of play as you can before the big dance comes around, which will, of course, be this summer in Tokyo. At this point, you just call up your best. You call up who's going to fit into that system the best, and you imagine they're going to try to play on the front foot a bit more than maybe they have in past tournaments, and the squad should be tailored to that, very simply put. We will see what happens with that friendly against England and whether they can build on the win against Wales. Obviously a much tougher challenge, but we'll see how the girls manage in that game. So that'll do it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please do not forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your podcasts. For Thomas Neff, I'm Peter Galindo. This has been episode 7 of the Northern Football Podcast.